Welcome to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on 90.1 KPFT FM and FM HD1 Houston, your community station. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there.
This next hour, we'll be discussing local, state, national, and international stories. First, I just want to mention, as a reminder, the next election is sneaking up on us. Early voting starts April 19th. The election is May 1st. There are sample ballots online at your respective county clerks. Tax day has been extended. I'm not going to take the risk of giving you the date. Check with your tax preparer or go to irs.gov and find out how it works for you between state, federal, local, wherever you happen to be. You might also be aware that you have until April 13th to renew your expired car registration, assuming that, like, you've been isolated and not going to inspection sites and whatnot. You have until April 13th to get that wrapped up. Okay, those are the public service announcements. Article from communityimpact.com, which I thought was interesting. How much more can we take? The pandemic leads to a rise in anxiety and depression in Cy-Fair. The story refers to a study done by Rice University's COVID-19 registry. And according to the percentages, 62% of respondents report increased nervousness, 57% report trouble relaxing, 56% are worrying too much, 56% are more easily annoyed, 47% fear something happening, but they're not sure what. 43% cannot control their worrying, and 33% experience extra restlessness. As the story goes, by December, Mental Health America of Greater Houston reported 66% of Harris and Fort Bend County residents screened were battling loneliness or social isolation, 31% dealing with financial problems, another 24% experiencing grief over loss. The organization offers free online screenings for youth and adults to gauge their mental health. That's the Mental Health America of Greater Houston. Local counselors have seen a rise in demand this past year. Many people still face barriers in accessing care. Mental Health America, a nonprofit, reported that 20.1% of Texas adults with a mental illness are uninsured, compared to the national average of 10.8%. Medicaid expansion. Rice University's COVID-19 registry, an ongoing survey designed to gauge local effects of the pandemic in real time, reported that 46% of Harris County residents are dealing with mild to severe anxiety. Vinaya Tumchak also noted significant increases in alcohol and substance abuse, eating disorders, and youth at risk for emotional, attentional, or behavioral disorders. Experts said that healthy coping mechanisms, such as limiting news consumption, connecting with loved ones, exercising, and meditating can lessen anxiety. Unhealthy responses include withdrawing from others, being self-critical, showing aggression or anger, and using alcohol or drugs to cope. In the story, they didn't actually provide phone numbers or links. In my blog post, I do have a link to the public mental health system of Harris County. You can go there and see perhaps if there's some assistance that might be available to you there, or maybe just referrals to other sources you can get. So, who would know that a year of either isolation or disease and hospitalization paranoia might prey on one's mind?
Yeah. Well, I find it very interesting. The article mentions one of the healthy coping mechanisms is limiting news consumption. Now, I wonder if that means people maybe shouldn't be listening to us right now.
We are not news. We are information and analysis.
That's true.
But so that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
I wonder if we have the same ability to raise blood pressure.
Well, we try not to. I mean, you know, you and I, with our different places in the spectrum, we get along very nicely most of the time, and that's how we try to present the information we discuss. I will say this, during the last 4 years, I know that my wife and my stepdaughter just tried to watch a lot less news. That was literally the same coping mechanism that is discussed in the story. If something is working up your temper, working up your blood pressure, working up your anxiety, you know, there's an old joke about an old man who goes to a doctor and says, "Doctor, when I use my left knee, it's hurting me, and I don't know what's wrong with it. It never hurt me before." And the doctor says, "Well, you know, you're 75 years old now." And he says, "Well, doctor, my right knee is just as old as my left knee. It's not bothering me." So everything is how you look at it, right?
Yeah. And if you get that news that does raise your blood pressure, hopefully, you know, by taking a little bit of our analysis with it, you can keep that blood pressure low. The
shameless plug, by the way.
We need your money, kpft.org/donate.
When you need somebody's money, you say that slower. kpft.org/donate.
Yes. But you mentioned the political differences between you and me, and this might be a sign of one of them playing out again. But, I mean, you know, I believe that most, if not all, of mental health, the underlying cause is the society we live in, the capitalist society we live in. So, you know, I think that by no means should we stop trying to help people who have mental health problems. Absolutely every little helps. But I don't think we'll ever eradicate them until we change the way we live, unfortunately.
Well,
which is a big undertaking.
I think that your, pardon the expression, your parochialism is showing, because you're blaming stress on capitalism. And I can tell you, having been in communist China, they are stressed too. So it's not capitalism. It's when you said societal, I was with you, because I think society, whatever kind of government you have, whatever kinds of culture you're living in, whatever your neighbors happen to be, all of those things contribute to mood and stress. And then, of course, there's neurology and neurochemistry. So all of that factors in to one degree or another, uniquely variable according to individuals. Next story, also from, actually, this is from Click 2 Houston. Texas will receive 2.5 million COVID-19 vaccine doses this week. Texas will get the doses, they said last Friday. More than two-thirds of Texans 65 and older have received at least one dose. Nearly half of 65 and older are now fully vaccinated. More than a third of all Texans 16 and older have received a dose. And nearly one in five 16 and older are fully vaccinated. This week, the Department of State Health Services, or DSHS, launched the Texas Public Health Vaccine Scheduler at, and the link is on the website, but I'll read it, getthevaccine.dshs.texas.gov. It's on my website for the show. This allows Texans to register for a vaccine appointment from a participating public health entity such as DSHS and also some local health departments, and as I've heard, soon coming to a pharmacy near you. I guess as sort of a follow-up, this is a story that we had intended for last week's show, except for technical difficulties, but it's still current.
Yeah.
No one gets left behind. Harris County prioritizes COVID-19 vaccine access for vulnerable residents. This is from communityimpact.com. More than 1 million COVID-19 vaccine doses have been distributed throughout Harris County as of March 25th, according to Judge Lena Hidalgo during a press conference on March 25th. She commended Harris County Public Health for reaching a higher proportion of vulnerable individuals compared to the overall vaccination rates by providers nationwide, and mentioning the importance of equitably vaccinating Black and Hispanic populations, among other demographics who traditionally lack access to health care. Black and Hispanic residents encompass 17.5% and 31.1% of individuals, respectively, who have had at least one dose from Harris County Public Health, compared to 9.8% and 19.9% of those countrywide. However, nearly 12% of individuals vaccinated by all providers countywide did not have a known race, according to a report. So the statistics are a little, you know, wonky. County initiatives to increase vaccine access for marginalized populations include bringing vaccines to the zip codes hit hardest by COVID-19, offering transportation to appointments for those who need it, visiting homeless shelters and nursing homes to register residents, and setting up a vaccine hotline, 832-927-8787. It'll be on the website for individuals without the capabilities to register online. Now, when I say the website, I should give the website. It's thinkwingradio.com, and go to the show tab, which is the second tab, I believe, on the site, and then you can see the show post, which will have links to everything that we discussed, basically. Andrew, I'm sure you've been biting your tongue waiting to contribute something.
Yep. I want to first say that the DSHS scheduler, I use that this evening, last evening. Time is weird for us. put my information into the county system or the state system, and hopefully I'll get my vaccine appointment scheduled at some point. But yeah, you know, it was a pretty painless process. You got to have your personal information. If you've got insurance, whether that's private or Medicaid or Medicare, have that on hand, and be prepared to answer some questionnaire questions. Pretty easy process. And they'll let you know when they have an opening. On the topic of access to vaccines, I had seen an article from ProPublica about undocumented people who, and documented people for that matter, who, immigrants who were having trouble accessing the vaccine because they were being asked at pharmacies if they had insurance, if they had private insurance, or if they had a social security number so that they could charge the government for that. And, thankfully a lot of people had, family members who spoke English. But if, a person who doesn't speak English, comes up to their pharmacy and they don't have anybody with them to advise them, and they're asked for insurance or a social security number, a lot of people were just leaving and not getting the vaccine because they didn't know how to answer those questions. They didn't know whether they'd be at risk of deportation if that was something that could happen to them if they said that they didn't have a social security number. So,
and that's a public health hazard.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because everyone needs to be vaccinated, and legal status does not determine whether you're at risk or putting other people at risk. So, that's a really, really important point. And they should not be asking. I mean, they can ask if you have medical insurance.
Right.
They should not be asking for social security numbers.
And it's important. I think they can ask for social security if they want to, charge the government. But you don't have to provide it. You don't have to provide either of those things. If you are an undocumented person, you are just as eligible to get the vaccine as anyone else. That's important to know.
I'm just wondering, is there anything in legislation that requires pharmacies to ask a question like social security number, or is that something that they have sort of decided they need but legally shouldn't ask?
To my knowledge, there is nothing requiring them to ask, but there's nothing preventing them from asking. There is just something that says you have to provide vaccines to anyone who wants them, regardless of whether they can pay or not.
Okay, before our break, I am going to make a suggestion. Mm-hmm. Anyone who goes for a vaccination, if you are asked, and I'm saying anybody, because mm-hmm. if this is something they shouldn't be doing, it's a habit that needs to be broken. If anyone asks you for your social security number in order to get a vaccination only, ask them why they need it.
Okay.
And if you don't feel that they give you a really satisfactory answer, ask them if you can decline to give it to them.
That's fair.
Not because you don't want to give them your social security number because you have a concern, but because if this is really not a required question that is inhibiting people from getting vaccinated, it's a habit we want to break.
Hmm. I can get behind that.
Okay, cool. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and after that, we're going to talk a little bit about the Houston real estate market. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM and FM HD1. My website, where I keep records of all the shows I do, I keep recordings, I keep notes with links, I keep phone numbers, and anything and everything that we've discussed, plus occasionally the opinion piece, thinkwingradio.com, thinkwingradio, one word, .com. You can also just do thinkwing.org. Actually, I don't mention it much, but it takes you to the same place. You can also follow me on Twitter at thinkwingradio. You can also follow me on Facebook, Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig. And I don't always do the same things on all of those platforms. Some platforms are more amenable to other things than some other platforms are. Also, KPFT, it's a community-operated station. It's a community service station, and it is completely funded by the community. So whenever you feel the inclination, whenever you feel the ability to send a few dollars, or at the other extreme, a bunch of dollars to KPFT, you can go to kpft.org and click on the donate link. Or, and sometimes this is simpler, you can text to 713-526-5738, text the word give, and it will respond and take you through an automated process, which is really, really simple. And when it asks you what show you're donating to, it would be nice if you said Think Wing Radio, but we're not going to twist your arm too hard to do that. Okay. Our next story has to do with the Houston real estate market, which, you know, for the last year, because of COVID, it's kind of counterintuitive. Houston's real estate remains insulated from February's Arctic blast. This is actually from the Houston Association of Realtors. The deadly and disruptive winter storm that left many Houston area homes without power and water, even after mild temperatures returned, did not chill local real estate in February. The increase was achieved, an increase in sales was achieved despite an ever-shrinking supply of homes and the first uptick in mortgage rates since last summer, all with the backdrop of the coronavirus pandemic. According to the latest Houston Association of Realtors, or HAR, market update, 6,049 single-family homes sold in February, compared to 5,979 for the same period last year. I guess we're not going to go into numbers too much, except to say that housing prices have gone up at the high end, housing prices have gone up at the middle end, and housing prices have gone up at the low end. Mm. Along with that, rents, of course, have gone up because with a shortage of houses, people still need to live someplace. So apartment rents are going up because the apartment market has gotten tighter. Unfortunately, this is probably something that Houston and other markets will be suffering from for the next 6 to 12 months, is my guess, from what I've seen of the market, from what I've discussed with people familiar with the market. The problems are manifold. First of all, you've got a stop in construction, essentially. So new home construction is slow or non-existent. You've got, because of COVID, supply issues, and also because now of storms, the demand issue, you've got a dramatic reduction in available construction supplies. Because you've got a dramatic reduction in construction supplies, you've got a dramatic increase in construction supply prices, which is also a deterrent because nobody wants to build a house that's now so expensive in the class of house you're building that people won't want to buy it. So we're going to see some significant dynamic tension in the housing market, housing being both houses and apartments, whether condos or leased. It's going to be challenging. It's going to be very challenging for the next 6 to 12 months at least.
Yeah, and I think because of that, sort of housing assistance programs are going to be really important during this period. You know, I don't know entirely what all is available in this area, but I'm sure that we probably have well, I think there is some either state or national.
There's always Section 8, but there's usually a waiting list. There may be comparable programs available at the city, county, and state levels, perhaps.
I remember seeing something about rent relief online as well.
Yeah, but that's mostly for existing apartment or leaseholders who have okay. have had trouble making rent.
Sure. Well, I know that some other cities in the country are sort of purchasing, you know, blocks of hotel rooms or purchasing hotels outright and using them as shelters, you know, temporary housing. A lot of those programs have very restrictive sort of curfew requirements and very restrictive sort of living requirements. So, you know, they're not being used as much as they could be, and they're not being as helpful as they could be. So, you know, if Houston is going to do something like that, which I think it should, you know, respect the humanity of the people who use those, you know, temporary places to live. But I would like to see, you know, the housing support infrastructure around here step up to prepare
for these new prices. Becomes the problem of construction planning, construction permits, construction supply prices. I will say this, you know, on this show, you and I have engaged in some occasional prognostication about how the world is going to change as a result of COVID, not just until we are vaccinated, but probably for generations to come.
Sure.
One of the things that we might want to keep an eye on is commercial properties being converted to residential properties.
Hmm.
Because there's a lot of vacant office space. I think it's gone from a typical vacancy rate of 10% in some cities to like 16 or even more percent. So there are commercial properties that are actually considering converting to residential apartments or condos.
That's
so
true.
This is going to be a very interesting time. It's going to be painful for a great many people. It's going to be very hard, as most generational changes are.
Mm.
But it's not like there isn't space covered by roofs. It's how is that space configured? And we may, you know, it's not like we're going to have people living in strip centers, although, you know, you put an actual front of a store, and yeah, you can have like stand aside small units.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what the future holds. I just know it's going to look a lot different, and housing may be one of the things that impels one of those differences.
Mm.
A Republican congressional candidate in Texas lost prominent supporters after racist comments about Chinese immigrants. Two of her Republican backers, the first Korean-American Republicans to serve in Congress, withdrew their endorsements on Friday after she said she doesn't want Chinese immigrants to come to America. Again, this is from the Texas Tribune. Sari Kim, a Korean-American, is running for Texas 06, the seat held by U.S. Representative Ron Wright from Arlington, who died of COVID. Kim has served in the Small Business Administration under Donald Trump. Her comments prompted California U.S. Reps Young Kim and Michelle Steele to rescind their endorsements of her on Friday. Kim and Steele are the first Korean-American Republican women to serve in Congress. The candidate, Sari Kim, has been unapologetic, however, arguing that she was speaking out against the Chinese Communist Party and blaming the, quote, liberal media for the uproar. She said, "I don't want them here at all of potential Chinese immigrants. They steal our intellectual property. They give us coronavirus. They don't hold themselves accountable. And quite frankly," she went on, "I can say that because I'm Korean." Asked for a comment on the loss of endorsements, Kim provided a one-sentence statement. I am shocked that in an effort to counter Asian American hate, the liberal media is targeting me, she said. An Asian and an immigrant, in an effort to paint me as anti-Asian and anti-immigrant just for speaking against the oppressive Chinese Communist Party. From what we know of her comment, she was really speaking about all Chinese immigrants as if they're all members of the Chinese Communist Party, which they are not, as if they are all stealing intellectual property, which they are not, and as if they are all spreading coronavirus, which they are not. Aside from that, what she said was perfectly fair. Sarcasm alert.
Yeah. Well, obviously, this is a terrible thing to say about you know, Chinese immigrants, any group of immigrants, but, you know, especially Chinese immigrants at this time, what they're dealing with in the United States. And frankly, I don't buy the excuse that she can say that because she's Korean. I think she's trying to sort of paint it as a pan-Asian statement when I don't think that is, you know, I think that's kind of something she sees as more advantageous. If she can claim it was, you know, she was an Asian immigrant talking about all Asian immigrants, I think she sees that as a more advantageous position than a Korean immigrant talking about Chinese immigrants. So, you know, I don't buy her excuse. I think what she said was abhorrent, and, you know, I hope she loses her election, quite frankly, but, you know, that's partisanship a little bit. So.
And after the break, we're going to talk about something new to me, judicial gerrymandering. Story links on ThinkWing Radio are available at thinkwingradio.com, where you can find all the stories we discuss and links and stuff we never even get to, as well as usually a lot of additional background material we don't have a chance to cover. You can stay in touch with us. You can write to thinkwingradio@msn.com or at thinkwing@kpft.org. Or you can write to me at Twitter at thinkwingradio, or you can go to my Facebook page, Thinkwing Radio. You can also go to the specific blog post if you have a comment on a specific show, and you can add a comment there. So all kinds of ways that you can contribute to the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Agree, disagree, elaborate, and we would love to hear from you.
Yes.
We would like that feedback, so do please feel free.
Mm.
Okay, next up, this is, I ran across this from Charles Kuffner. He has a website called offthecuff.com, and he picked up on a story. Texas Republicans now are not only gerrymandering election districts, they're looking at gerrymandering judicial districts. And Charles headlined his story, "Let's Get Rid of Democratic Appellate Court Justices." He goes on to write, "If that's the legislature's goal, then this would be an effective way of accomplishing it." From law360.com, he cites, "A Texas Senate committee heard public comment Thursday on a controversial proposal to consolidate the state's 14 intermediate appellate courts into just 7, a move opponents have criticized as gerrymandering, but that supporters say will make the courts more efficient and cure knotty court splits." Of course, if you want to make it really efficient, I suppose we can just have one appellate court. Story goes on. Opponents of the consolidation plan say it is blatant gerrymandering and the worst instance of it they've seen in the Texas judiciary. Elsa Alcala, a former justice on the First Court of Appeals in Houston and Texas's Court of Criminal Appeals, took to Twitter to call out the plan, writing, quote, "This has nothing to do with justice and everything to do with electing Republicans to the bench." Since 2018, the article goes on, the 2018 general election, a wave of Democratic justices have ousted Republicans from Texas appellate benches in record numbers, largely concentrated in urban population centers. According to Charles, writing, Katie Buehler, the reporter of the story linked above, attended the hearing and reported that Senator Nathan Johnson said it would be a 5-2 split. In other words, 5 Republican appellates and 2 Democratic appellates. "Whatever the case," she says, "I guarantee you that's," or Charles says, "I guarantee you that someone with strong Republican credentials has already done such an analysis, and these districts are drawn in a maximally beneficial way for Republicans." Charles says, "You've read many bloviations from him over the years about why calls to change the way we select judges from the current system of partisan elections to something else were mostly a smokescreen to discuss complaints about the fact that Democrats were now winning many of those elections. It has never escaped his notice," Charles's, "that we only began seeing these calls for change after the 2008 election when Democrats broke through in Harris County and it moved to DEFCON 1 following the 2018 election. If nothing else, Charles thanks Senator Joan Huffman for putting the lie to the idea that the motivating factor behind those calls for change was a fairer or more equitable or more merit-based system for picking judges, or that, quote, taking politics out of the system had anything to do with it. No, It's exactly what Charles thought it was from the beginning, a means to ensure that as many judges are Republican as possible. There may well be legitimate merits to rethinking the appellate court system in Texas. He's not an appellate lawyer, he has no idea, but it's crystal clear that this ain't it. This is a full employment program for Republicans who want to be judges, and that's what we'll get if this bill passes. Charles finds and writes about and writes in a way that can be really, really compelling. And I think that he's done an enormous service here, which is why I really wanted to cover or report or read as much of that as I felt was possible within the context of the time limits of the show. I mean, the illogic of saying that you're going to take 14 appellate courts. Now, mind you, Texas is the second most populous state in the union. So, of course, we need fewer appellate courts with fewer appellate judges, or that fewer of those courts have more Republican judges. None of it makes any sense except as a political power play.
Right.
Andrew?
Now, I think there is perhaps some merit to the idea that judges should not be elected, because, you know, you get a very common tactic of judges who are trying to get elected or trying to judicial candidates trying to attack currently serving judges who will say, you know, I'm tough on crime, this person's soft on crime. And in my opinion, that doesn't help anyone. But
well, appointed judges have their drawbacks too. There's no perfect system.
Agreed. At least not one that we know of right now. Off the top of our heads. But I think that in this case, this is obviously just a power grab. I agree with Charles' assessment here. You know, this is just a way for Republicans to try and consolidate their power in Texas. And it's not good. We should oppose it, I think.
Absolutely. Actually, one of the things I would like to see is suggestions for how people motivated to oppose it can oppose it. I mean, should you call your Texas senator, your Texas legislator, write to the governor? I mean, I'm not an on the street kind of person. I use my voice as much as I can. I send money to political causes when I can. That's my way of fighting these things. But it would be nice to have a focus of how to do that. Okay, next up, you may have heard that the Biden administration is working to develop a system for people to prove they've been vaccinated. This is from CNN. This is actually from about a week ago. Multiple government agencies are engaged in conversations and planning coordinated by the White House, as this kind of system will play a role in multiple aspects of life, including potentially the workforce, an official said. Some sectors, like the travel industry, have clamored for a uniform system to be developed as they seek to return to normalcy. Governments around the world may seek proof of vaccinations before foreigners can enter their borders again. CNN previously reported that several companies and technology groups have begun developing smartphone apps or systems for individuals to upload details of their COVID-19 tests and vaccinations, creating digital credentials that could be shown in order to enter concert venues, stadiums, movie theaters, offices, or even countries. And before going into the next story, I'll mention really quickly that I think it is mentioned in the story or someplace else I've read that it is not unusual for certain countries to require vaccinations, whether it's for yellow fever or malaria. Certain countries, before you get a visa, you get vaccinated. So this is not unheard of. Now, the next story is actually from just 2 or 3 days ago, and this is from clickorlando.com. The Florida governor, Rick DeSantis, signed an executive order banning vaccine passport use at businesses. He says, quote, "We will not have COVID vaccines mandated in Florida." Well, let's see what other good ideas he has. The executive order prevents any Florida government entity from issuing a vaccine passport to prove that a person has been vaccinated for COVID-19. The order also bans businesses in Florida from requiring customers to provide COVID-19 vaccine documentation to gain access or services. The order says, quote, "Requiring so-called COVID-19 vaccine passports for taking part in everyday life, such as attending a sporting event, patronizing a restaurant, or going to a movie theater, would create two classes of citizens based on vaccination, unquote. According to the governor's order, vaccines are not mandated in Florida, and an individual's decision to get a vaccine is private health information. This, by the way, has been contradicted by most public officials. DeSantis said there was never under discussion any mandates to take vaccines. We will not have COVID vaccines mandated in Florida. He goes on, the flip side of that, though, with these vaccine passports, is it's completely unacceptable for either the government or the private sector to impose upon you the requirement that you show proof of vaccine to just simply be able to participate in normal society. The executive order prohibiting vaccine passports is temporary and would need to be extended. DeSantis said he would work with the Florida legislature to find a more permanent solution to restrict the use of vaccine passports. So, it's a public health issue. Mm-hmm. Where being vaccinated, I mean, it's kind of like when they used to get smallpox and polio vaccines we still need to get. As a public health issue, the government does have the power to require either vaccination or isolation. The government can, in an emergency, require that. They don't want to, but here you have a governor saying not only that you don't have to be vaccinated, but, you know, private property, freedom, liberty, except that you can't have people who might spread disease in your establishment come onto your private property and cause other people not to want to come there because they might become fatally ill. So, you know, this again goes back to the Republican double standard. We want your freedom, except when we don't want you to have it because it goes against what we believe you should do.
Right.
Andrew, well, have I left anything out?
I would actually talk a little bit about the concept of the vaccine passports. Now, I could see some arguments of, you know, privacy concerns, data security concerns, and I think that's fair. I would think that I personally would not trust a, you know, private sector vaccine passport. I think if there was going to be something like that, I would say it would need to be, you know, government administrated, government mandated, government built, and it would need to be some sort of piece of official paperwork. Maybe a stamp of its own in your actual real passport. And, you know, maybe, you know, a mobile app, you know, vulnerabilities with that. But,
well, one thing I will say that occurred to me while you were commenting is there, I mean, I don't think there's really a right to medical privacy in this particular instance. This is not like a disclosure of your medical history. I will say this. And maybe there are other considerations, but this is the one I came up with. For people who, for some reason, should not be vaccinated, and there is a small percentage of people that, for various health reasons, should not risk vaccination. That's why the herd immunity aspect is so important. To say that I have been vaccinated or I don't have to be vaccinated because I have a health issue, that would be a violation of medical privacy. So I think that whatever kind of, and maybe this is one of the reasons it's been delayed in coming out, they thought they would do it faster. Maybe what it has to say is something not that I have been vaccinated, but that, use some other wording, I can't think of the wording at the moment, but some other wording that says I am clear to go into public and private spaces.
Right.
Or something to that effect that doesn't reveal your status of, I'm an exceptional person, I can't get a vaccine, but because of that, I'm allowed to go where I want anyway.
Right. I think, to me, the privacy concern is less, you know, whether you've, you know, assuming you've been able to go and get the vaccine and you chose not to, whatever. It's less about that. It's more about if it ties into the rest of your medical history, which these things sometimes do. And, you know, a system that ties into another system is a point of entry. If you can, you know, if a nefarious actor can compromise that point of entry, they've got a point of entry into the larger system. So
that kind of comes back to asking for your social security number or some other form of ID.
Right.
Which then gets into, well, if you're undocumented, you may not have any form of legal ID. Mm. Which, of course, then goes back to in places like California where even undocumented immigrants are allowed to have driver's licenses, which then serve as ID.
Hmm.
Yeah, this there start to be layers of this, and I can see why it will take a committee and some legislative staffers to figure out what, if, and how to get this done.
Sure.
Next story is from CNBC.com. Republican Roy Blunt calls on Biden to slash massive infrastructure plan from approximately $2.25 trillion to $615 billion. Blunt is the fourth highest ranking Republican in the Senate. He said he wants bipartisan support, or rather Biden has said he wants bipartisan support for the plan, but Republicans have staunchly opposed any tax hikes, arguing they could hinder economic recovery. Democrats would need to use budget reconciliation to pass the bill unless the White House changes the proposal to satisfy Republicans. So here's the thing. I mean, there's more to, actually, this is a good line to the story. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said last week that the relief package or the infrastructure package would not receive Republican support and vowed to oppose the broader Democratic agenda. He said, quote, "I'm going to fight them every step of the way because I think this is the wrong prescription of America." Now, Rachel Maddow made the observation, this is great news for the Democrats because they don't have to go through the kabuki show of trying to negotiate with Republicans to shape a bill that's smaller than the Democrats want, that Republicans say is more acceptable, and then not get a single Republican vote anyway. So, good news, everybody. We know the Republicans aren't going to vote for it. The Democrats might as well do what they want.
Well,
Andrew,
I sure hope that that's the conclusion the Democrats come to. But, you know, they've had opportunities in the past where they haven't needed Republican support, but they've gone after it anyway and ended up passing something watered down. So I wouldn't be surprised if that happens again. I'm hoping it doesn't, but I wouldn't be surprised.
I think the wider common wisdom is the Democrats have learned those lessons. You and I had the discussion where we talked about bipartisanship, and I made the point, well, you know, if they have the majority, even if it's slender, all they have to do is negotiate among themselves. Mm-hmm. I think they understand that, and I think that's precisely what they're going to be doing.
Mm. Well, we'll just have to see. We thought they've learned that lesson before, and it turned out they haven't. So we'll have to see. Hey, maybe this is the time. Maybe this is the time.
Maybe. Hey, hope springs eternal. Metaphorical, yeah. Fingers crossed. You can't see it because it's radio. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to talk about having to explain free speech to angry parlor users after the Capitol riots. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM and FM HD1. You can donate to the station if you like this show or other talk shows, community information shows, music shows, of which we have many, and many are great. You can support KPFT by going to kpft.org. clicking on the donate jar, picking the show you want to support, hint, I'd like you to pick this one, but you don't have to, and contributing whatever you feel you can afford, whether it's a couple of bucks or $5 or 50 or 500, perhaps, maybe, you know, a couple of times a year you do that. You can do a monthly, you can get thank you gifts. There's all kinds of ways you can do this. You can even text. You can text a way to contribute to KPFT. It's a number that this is the only way we remember it now, 713-526-5738. And I'll say it again, 713-526-5738. Text the word give, and it'll take you through an automated process asking you all the questions, who you are, what show you're supporting, how much you'd like to give, how you'd like to do it. All of that would be taken care of. And while we're talking about contact for KPFT and donations, you can also contact us. One of the ways to contact me is on Twitter, at ThinkWingRadio. And Andrew?
You can find me on Twitter as well, at DominateEYE, and spell the same on Tumblr, at DominateI.tumblr.com. My Ask box is open. And so if you've got any comments or questions about the show or what we talk about here, drop them to us, and we'll do our best to respond. Because we like you. We enjoy spending time with you every week.
We do. And we appreciate your spending time with us. And I may have sounded facetious when I said that, but really, honest to gosh, I wasn't.
Yeah.
We really do. We're flattered, truly. Okay, from Mashable from about a week ago, and I just thought this is an interesting story to mention. According to the headline, Parler explains free speech to angry users after sharing Capitol riot posts with the FBI. Just as Congress was finishing up grilling the CEOs of Facebook, Google, and Twitter at a hearing, Parler published its response to a separate congressional inquiry into the company's ties and finances. In its letter, Parler accused the big tech companies of trying to scapegoat the right-wing social network in order to avoid their accountability for their roles in what transpired on January 6th. Parler also called for an investigation into collusion between big tech companies and alleged anti-competitive practices. One major point of Parler focuses on its letter is that the company referred violent content and incitement from Parler's platform over 50 times before January 6th, as well as specific threads of violence relating to events being planned at the Capitol on January 6th. So one Parler user commented, "So your snitches over nothing but Democrat-conspired BS?" And Parler found itself unironically explaining the First Amendment to its user base filled with members who declare themselves to be constitutionalists and free speech advocates. Parler's statement begins, "Some users have raised questions about the practice of referring violent or inciting content to law enforcement. The First Amendment does not protect violence-inciting speech, nor the planning of violent acts. Such content violates Parler's terms of service. Any violent content shared with law enforcement was posted publicly and brought to our attention primarily via user reporting. And as it is posted publicly, it can properly be referred to law enforcement by anyone. Parler remains steadfast in protecting your right to free speech." This ticked off a lot of their users. But, you know, free speech. Government cannot limit your speech. It says nothing about what private enterprise does, but you know capitalism.
And it also says that you can't, you know, you're not immune from consequences for what you say as well.
And you're not guaranteed a platform.
Yeah. I found it very interesting. One user's reply was, quote, "I want some response to the farce that we called an election. Sometimes violence is the answer." And you know what? I would agree with that, but violence is not the answer to something like, oh, say, being upset that you lost an election. That's not the time for violence.
Or being upset that your public threats were then reported to law enforcement.
Right.
You know,
that's not the time.
Yeah, that's no. Okay, next story. This is from NBCNews.com. Postal banking alcohol delivery could save the U.S. Postal Service, experts say. Postal banking is an elegant solution that would provide the Postal Service upwards of $9 billion a year in revenue and would address the high cost of being poor in America, said Rakeem Brooks, senior campaign strategist for the American Civil Liberties Union. Postal banking is among the new services the post office of the 21st century could and should provide. It would include basic banking services like check cashing, providing low or no fee checking accounts, installing low fee ATM machines, and providing wire transfer and bill payment services. Postal banking is a win-win solution. It can help the post office's bottom line and serve millions of Americans that are currently underbanked or unbanked, which, by the way, is a real problem. Brooks said, referring to the more than 30 million Americans who do not have sufficient access to mainstream financial services or no bank accounts at all, often because of the fees associated with them. Postal banking is not a new concept. It was part of the menu of services the post office offered for decades beginning in 1910, when Congress established the postal savings system to encourage people to put their money in financial services as opposed to like under a mattress. By 1947, the postal banking system had $3.4 billion in deposits. That's 1947 dollars. But in the 1960s, interest in the program waned when commercial banks started offering higher interest rates. And in 1967, postal banking was phased out. So essentially within my lifetime. Porter McConnell, who runs the Save the Post Office Coalition, says it's now time for postal banking to make a comeback. And the article goes on. It talks about FedEx and UPS being allowed to deliver alcohol and spirits. And that's actually something that the post office could also legitimately do with an act of Congress. You know, this goes back to having, according to the article, at least 10% of the American population unbanked or underbanked, which makes them subject to things like predatory lending, endless fees on cashing their checks, paying their utility bills, paying their rent. So literally the people who can least afford extra fees are the people most likely to pay extra fees.
Right.
And there's more to this article that I couldn't excerpt and more even than I could read here, but that's the upshot of it.
Yeah. Andrew? The banks, private banks, offering better interest rates and then the postal banking being shuttered. It's a classic example of the private sector, you know, undermining a public service and then not, you know, slowly backing away from filling the role of that public service when the public service doesn't exist anymore. So
because private enterprises can move faster than government, so they can screw you faster than government can fix it.
Right. They're only focused on profit. But what's interesting to me about this is the talk about alcohol delivery in the postal service. That's never something I've heard about. You hear about postal banking a reasonable amount, I think, but I've never heard about the Postal Service not being allowed to deliver alcohol. It's a prohibition era regulation, so yeah, I mean, you know, Congress could reverse it, and yeah, there are
basically some people in the article who be allowed to, whether it did or
right,
not.
Right, and there are plenty of people in the article who are very in favor of allowing the Postal Service to deliver alcohol. Makes sense.
And of course, companies like FedEx and UPS that are not.
Right.
So there's that. Okay, one last story we wanted to cover because I think it's an international story in many ways. It's also a national story in many ways. And this is from NewYorker.com. The historians are under attack for exploring Poland's role in the Holocaust. To exonerate the nation of the murders of 3 million Jews, the Polish government will go as far as to prosecute scholars for defamation. And the story goes, two Polish historians of the Holocaust, Jan Grabowski and Barbara Engelking, are fighting a court ruling that pronounced them guilty of defaming a long-deceased Polish village official. The book, in the book Night Without End, The Fate of Jews in Selected Counties of Occupied Poland, published in 2018, it actually did very well in terms of academic acclaim and even brisk sales for a two-volume, 1,700-page scholarly title. One chapter, written by Engelking, mentioned Edward Molinowski, the pre-war mayor of a small village, and my pronunciations, just forgive me, Molinowo. According to testimony uncovered by Engelking, Molinowski led the Nazis to Jews who were hiding in the forest outside the village. 22 people were killed. Last month, the Warsaw District Court found that this passage of Night Without End defamed Molinowski and ordered Grabowski and Engelking to apologize in print. They have appealed the ruling. The two historians' legal problems stem from the Polish government's ongoing effort to exonerate Poland, both ethnic Poles and the Polish state, of the deaths of 3 million Jews in Poland during the Nazi occupation. When facts get in the way of this revisionist effort, historians pay the price. In 2016, Polish authorities charged the Polish-American historian Jan Tomasz Gross, author of the groundbreaking book Neighbors, The Destruction of the Jewish Community in Jawabna, Poland, with insulting the Polish people for his observation that Poles killed more Jews than Germans during the Second World War. The case dragged on in the Polish courts for 3 years, with Gross subjected to hours of public interrogations. The government also threatened to strip Gross of the Order of Merit of the Republic of Poland, a state honor he had received in 1996. The state did drop the charges after Gross retired from his job at Princeton University. Over 2019 and 2020, Dariusz Stola, the head of Warsaw's acclaimed Museum of Polish Jewry, found himself slowly squeezed out of his job again by the Polish government. More time for discussion of this would be nice, but the point here is Poland is guilty of this. The United Kingdom is guilty of this. France is guilty of this. The United States is guilty of this. There probably is not a country in the world that tries to literally and figuratively whitewash its history. And history needs to be honest in order for us to learn from it. Andrew, anything?
I find that this is a favorite tactic of conservatives to try and absolve themselves of the things they've done wrong. And, you know, I see similarities to, you know, the lies that the Trump administration told during the time in office. So, yeah, I think that I agree with everything you said. You know, history needs to be honest, because if it's not honest, we can't move forward.
Let any country without guilt cast the first stone. Okay, you've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on 90.1 KPFT FM and FM HD1 in Houston, your community station. My co-host and indispensable editor and very patient partner is Andrew Ferguson. And we hope you've enjoyed it. We hope you've learned something from it. And we'll look forward to speaking to you again next week. Y'all take care.
See you later.
Can't you see the morning after? It's waiting right outside the storm. Why don't we cross the bridge together and find the place that's safe and warm? It's not too late.
Outsmart is an award-winning monthly publication that has delivered local and national news to Houston's LGBT audience for over two decades. The magazine is published online and can be found at www.outsmartmagazine.com. Also available in print edition. Search for one of the magazine's 375-plus distribution locations around the greater Houston area. Outsmart Magazine's featured content includes news, columns, arts and entertainment, a lifestyle section, bar and club guides, and more. You're listening to 90.1 FM, KPFT Houston, Pacifica Radio for Peace. Tune in worldwide at kpft.org.